From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump has canceled a scheduled meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin at this weekend's G20 summit in Argentina, blaming Russia's refusal to return the ships it recently seized from Ukraine. He made the announcement aboard Air Force One en route to Buenos Aires. And today he also canceled meetings with the leaders of Turkey and South Korea. Joining us now is NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie in Washington. Hi, Greg.
Hey, Jeremy.
So in his mid-air tweet canceling the sit-down with Putin, he cited Russia's seizure of Ukrainian ships and sailors last weekend near the disputed territory of Crimea. But up to this point, that meeting was still on, even after that had happened. Why the last-minute change?
We can speculate on it. But again, this was an event, this Russian seizure of the Ukrainian ships that took place on Sunday, where the three ships were taken, 24 sailors seized. And even this morning, just as the president was getting ready to head out, he told reporters that it was a very good time to have a meeting with Putin. His national security advisor had said this meeting was going forward. Trump had said he wasn't happy with this Russian action, but he wasn't really condemning them. So the president seemed all for this meeting until just this morning, until he got on the plane, really.
Well, could it be in part that he doesn't want another Helsinki? He doesn't want another moment where he has the opportunity to stand up to Putin, and then he doesn't?
Absolutely. I mean, that's got to be in his mind. That was just back in July where he had a one-on-one summit with Putin in Helsinki, Finland, and he got very bad reviews. As he stood next to Putin, he was very friendly. He didn't condemn the Russian meddling in the 2016 elections, and he really got savaged when he came back from that. So that has to be a big part of his thinking as well. He didn't want another summit that brought just universally negative reviews.
Okay, now the other speculation out there today is that maybe this had something to do with what happened just this morning when Trump's longtime attorney Michael Cohen entered a guilty plea in a federal court admitting that he lied to Congress about discussions to build a Trump Tower in Moscow. Did that timing have anything to do with this decision?
You have to think that it did. This is such terrible optics. It's what everybody would be talking about, and it's not something the president wants to talk about. So he'd be in this very difficult position. And also, Cohen's the lie that Cohen has pleaded guilty to is about the possibility of a Trump Tower in Moscow. So it's not only part of the Russia investigation, it's directly related to Russia. So this was going to cause him headaches. And so I think it seems, without knowing or without him saying so directly, this was just going to be a headache for his entire time at the G20 summit.
And just to connect the dots for people, Trump had said during the campaign that he had no deals with Russia. This is Cohen saying that, in fact, he had a number of conversations even during the campaign with the president, with Donald Trump at the time, about this potential Trump Tower in Moscow, which never happened.
Right. But there would still be lots of questions about the contradictions from what the president has said previously to what Michael Cohen seems to be saying now.
So the other big question at this summit has to do with how Trump will deal with the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. He is not meeting with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, who some have blamed for being involved with it, but was going to meet with Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Khashoggi was killed in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Now that meeting appears to be off, too.
Yes. I mean, I think Erdogan would want to talk about this killing. Sprinkled out the details. He wants to use it as leverage with the Saudis and perhaps also with the United States. The president doesn't want to talk about it. He said he's standing behind Saudi Arabia, but Trump is starting to see the blowback, I think, for his position there. Its relations here with Erdogan have gotten even more complicated. We saw a Senate vote about the U.S. role in supporting Saudi in the war. So we're seeing the blowback there.
So just briefly, the meeting that hasn't been canceled yet is the one with the president of China. Could there be another trade deal announced or an end to the trade war?
No one's expecting it. We're expecting nice words, but no deal. Both sides are still waiting for the other side to say uncle first. So look for them to be kind to one another, but not to have any breakthroughs.
That's NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie as we watch the ever-shrinking summit, it seems like, between all these countries meeting in Argentina. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Ammon Bundy, the rancher who became a conservative hero, first in 2014 in a standoff with the government over unpaid grazing fees, and again in 2016 when his family led a standoff with federal officials in Oregon, is now respectfully but firmly disagreeing with President Trump on what he says is Trump's fear-based anti-immigrant rhetoric. Bundy and his family were cleared of standoff charges in court. Another rancher family, the Hammonds, was pardoned by President Trump. But Bundy is parting with Trump now in a Facebook video criticizing Trump and the media and those on the left who he says just want to give migrants welfare, and the media and people on the right who say migrants are terrorists paid by George Soros. Ammon says migrants are embattled families and workers. He joins us from his home in Emmett, Idaho. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you've gotten a lot of feedback, and we want to hear that. But first, you say, yes, there are perhaps some bad guys in these thousands of migrants who are coming. But you researched and found an impossible situation in the country, Honduras, that they were leaving. What did you find?
Well, I tried to go to sources that I can rely on that didn't have motives one way or the other. And what I found was stories like Christian, 34, who basically said he shuttered up his small business and left San Pedro after gang members demanded that $83 per month for protection payment. And that's a fifth of his income. There was others that said that they faced death threats after calling the police on a gang. And this is what the stories that I'm finding in Honduras and the reasons why they were wanting to flee from there.
Yeah, that's on that side, the incoming side. On this side, you very strongly tell your followers, and you have many, this is also about a labor crisis in this country.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm an employer. All of us are struggling to find people that are willing to work. And it just seems counterproductive or just opposite of what we need to keep people out of this country that are willing to work when we're in such a need.
Well, in fact, you say, you and your wife, between the need for laborers, but also the sympathy you have for these migrants, you take some in.
Absolutely. In fact, I put together and have it on my Facebook page, an actual form where people can start basically saying they would be willing to sponsor families. I want to collect, hopefully tens of thousands of names of people that would sponsor these refugees and give them to the president and show them that there's people that can sponsor these families and it wouldn't be a cost to the American taxpayer.
You also say that there are laws that these migrants coming in have a right to be considered for asylum. But first, do you see how some people would see some irony in Ammon Bundy saying this? Because you and your family famously disagreed with laws having to do with grazing rights. And I don't want to get into a debate over grazing rights, but people might see some irony in someone who didn't seem to respect one law now calling for respect of another law, the right to apply for asylum.
Yeah, so it's interesting. And I was very surprised with, if you will, kind of the left side response and their support to this video, but then some of their comments of what they thought we were before this video. From the beginning, all the way from the Bundy Ranch to what went on in Oregon, was all about humanity, defending and protecting personal rights, and about basically injustices that were being done to people. And so I think this is very consistent because it is government taking rights, harming people. And about fulfilling the true purpose of the government, which is benefiting mankind.
Well, I urge people to join the conversation on your Facebook page because it's a fascinating one. But in the meantime, the feedback you've also gotten from your followers is pretty stunning, too. You say from the right, you've gotten death threats. You've gotten people who came to join the militia to protect you against the federal government saying they now wish the government had killed you.
Yeah, it's interesting because when my family stood in 2014 on our ranch, and when we went to Oregon to help the Hammonds, I got death threats, multiple, from the left side. And now that I'm making public that I support refugees coming in here legally, I'm getting death threats from the conservative side.
Well, you might, in some people's eyes, make some interesting choices, but your question is, what would Christ do?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question. I mean, Christ himself, when he was just a toddler, his family had to flee to Egypt because Herod was killing all the young male children under 2 years old. He was fleeing and a refugee himself. All throughout his teachings, he teaches us that we are to befriend the stranger, that we are not to turn them away. It's about that, not about, you know, race or even borders, boundaries, or governments that man created.
Ammon Bundy will post his shout-out to President Trump and others to help the migrants who are currently gathered at the border seeking asylum. We'll put it at hereandnow.org. And people can continue the conversation with you, Ammon, at your Facebook page and at hereandnow.org. Ammon, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
And by the way, given his own past actions, we asked Ammon Bundy if he'd support migrants crossing the border illegally. He said no, because ultimately they need to live out of the shadows here. So again, for his video and a link to that list he's keeping to send to the president, people willing to sponsor a migrant family, go to hereandnow.org. A few events in recent weeks got us thinking about American captives abroad. The first was a ceremony in New Hampshire honoring slain journalist James Foley, brutally murdered by ISIS in Syria in 2014. The New Hampshire Supreme Court awarded him the Life and Liberty Award for individuals who've demonstrated excellence and bravery in the world of human rights. The second was a statement by federal officials saying they believe Marine-turned-journalist Austin Tice, a captive in Syria since 2012, is still alive. Now, three American prisoners were released from North Korea this year, and then there was the tragic return of Otto Warmbier. He was brought back from North Korea in a coma after a year of detention. He died 6 days after coming home. So who is out there now, and who's thinking about them? Well, Diane Foley is James Foley's mother and is now president and founder of the James W. Foley Legacy Foundation, which advocates for the safe return of Americans unjustly detained abroad. Diane, welcome back.
Thank you, Robin.
And your son, the journalist, horribly in the limelight during his capture in 2014. He'd also been held hostage once before in 2011. First of all, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. We've been busier than ever, though, Robin. Mm-hmm. There are more and more U.S. nationals being taken hostage or unjustly detained around the world.
Yeah.
It's primarily a rather silent crisis, if you will.
Yeah, well, let's make a little noise about it then. We also know that things go on behind the scenes. That was happening when your son was held hostage. President Obama authorized a complicated attempt at rescue. It failed. But we are hearing now from government officials that they are working very hard to try to bring Austin Tice home. Tell us more about who he is and his situation.
Well, Austin was a young man actually that Jim knew and was concerned about on his last trip home to visit in October of 2012. Austin has now been missing for six long years. Mm-hmm. He is a young Texan who was a Marine and was in Georgetown Law School and was taking a break over the summer to do some reporting in Syria.
Yeah, you said he was and then quickly switched it to he is. How much of your work is keeping this positive attitude that these people are alive?
I think it is vital. And in the case of Austin, we're very hopeful.
Yeah.
Much of the intelligence says that he is alive.
Yeah.
So I think the difficulty is bringing him home. Particularly.
So what'd you make of just last week, special presidential envoy for hostage affairs, Robert O'Brien, made the announcement that the U.S. government believes Austin Tice is alive. He also said that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has been intimately involved in Tice's case. What'd you make of all that?
I just applaud that. I was so grateful when Robert O'Brien was recently named the special envoy for hostage affairs because vacancy a real problem in the past year.
He spoke at the National Press Club and noted
yes.
that news organizations are also working feverishly to bring Austin Tice home. And we remember that your son was working at the time for Global Post. Phil Balboni worked tirelessly to try to get your son home. Are you in touch with any of these news organizations, or is anyone in the government talking to you about these searches?
Oh, yes. Yeah. That is part of our advocacy work, Robin. Mm-hmm. I feel it's very important to engage with the hostage fusion cell, the hostage envoy, and periodically with the White House hostage recovery group, because bringing Americans home is a very complex issue, particularly depending on who the captor is. If it's a government or a terrorist group, criminal gang, all of those different entities make a difference.
Who is thought to be holding Austin Tice? Because there's been talk of approaching Russians who back the Syrian government, which is winning the wars there. Who do you think is holding him?
Well, I mean, there's nothing definitive, but most everything points to the government, the Assad regime, holding him.
Yeah.
And he, of course, has kept people for years.
Right.
So that's partly what makes the family and all of us hopeful that with the right type of negotiation and persistence that he can be, in fact, freed. But you know, Robin, there are many, many others. Robert Levinson, for example, now 11 years, last seen in Iran. And the Princeton graduate student, Wang, a brilliant young man. They're on a special educational visa studying and arrested.
Well, just to pause for a second on Robert Levinson, this is the former FBI agent who is in Iran. You mentioned Wang, the student. But on Levinson's 70th birthday this year, his family and FBI colleagues had a celebration. They put out a statement reminding people of his, you know, presumed captivity and the $5 million reward for information leading to his return, and called on the government of Iran to uphold their commitment to find him. Do you believe in that case that Iran is committed to finding him?
My opinion is that they know where he is. I feel a lot of governments, such as Iran, use people as tokens. That's what hostage taking is all about. It's about gaining some sort of an advantage over another. And unfortunately, with countries like Iran and North Korea, they use hostage taking as a ploy against our citizens, really. It's more about our government, as in the case of our son, Jim. Mm-hmm. Jim certainly was not doing any harm to the people who kidnapped him. But because he was an American, he represented any hatred or untoward feelings that those captors had towards our country. So a lot of times our citizens are, in fact, targets because of political policy, political opinions, dissension, that sort of thing.
You know, you've spoken of Jim a couple times now. Diane Foley, how is it that you can do this work? Because every single day while you're doing your work, you must be thinking of him. Isn't that rubbing something in a wound?
Well, Jim challenges me, Robin, in a big way. Jim was an incredibly special young man. I truly don't think I realized what an amazing man he had become. But I failed in bringing him home because I was clueless. I had no idea how any of this worked. Mm. So after he was killed, I have been challenged to do all I can do to help other families in this situation, because it is an incredibly frightening, lonely, panic-filled time for people. And I think something very important for our country to have the back of brave young Americans who go out in the world, be they journalists, humanitarian workers, educators, or businessmen. My goal is that our country will make the return of our Americans a priority.
Another captive you feature, Reza Robin Shahini, a dual American-Iranian citizen. We know where he is. He's in, being held in prison. I mean, the list goes on, and we'll link people at hereandnow.org. You know, I'm sure people listening would say, you can't fail at the impossible. But I hear you in saying that you'd like to, you know, help other people do maybe more than you felt you could do. We know that Austin Tice's parents, Mark and Deborah Tice, we've spoken with them, our hearts are with them. They're planning to go back to, I think it'll be their seventh trip to the area where, you know, their son is being held in Syria. Do you recommend it or not?
That's a very good question, Robin. I did not do that. I was deterred from doing that.
By the government or?
By friends and the government.
Yeah.
I can understand their need to do that. And I do think it definitely puts pressure on the captors. I guess I can look at our situation. I went to the media hoping that awareness of Jim's situation would make a difference. But perhaps that makes a captive more valuable to those who've captured him. And that's what I was told at that time. So part of what the Foley Foundation is trying to do is to figure out some of this and figure out what are the best strategies. Because at this point, I don't feel that we really know. In 2015, this new structure was set in place by President Obama's presidential directive. So we now have Fusion Cell, Hostage Envoy, and Recovery Group, whose mission it is to bring Americans home. But we don't yet know how effective that is going to be. Is that, in fact, the best way? Or is it more effective through a private security group or a family's plea? We really don't have answers for that, Robin, but that is part of our goal, is to make that something that we can at least offer better advice to families in this horrific situation.
Get the answers that you wish you had.
Absolutely. So I just want any family in this situation to know that the Foley Foundation is available, as is Hostage US, which we started in 2015 to confidentially help families with any needs that might have been brought up by the captivity of a loved one.
Diane Foley, president and founder of the James W. Foley Legacy Foundation, again named for her son, Jim, killed by ISIS in Syria in 2014. And we'll link you to all this terrific work that she's been doing since. Diane, thank you so much.
Robin, you're wonderful. Thank you for your time, Robin. Happy holidays.
Oh, you too.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
It has been a much calmer day on Wall Street after yesterday's surge. The Dow jumped about 2.5% yesterday, its biggest single-day advance in 8 months, after Fed Chair Jerome Powell said that interest rates are just below neutral. Robin Farzad hosts the podcast Full Disclosure. He joins us now. Hi, Robin.
Jeremy, how are you?
I'm doing well, but apparently not as well as they were doing on Wall Street yesterday. Why did investors love those comments so much, just below neutral?
There's this idea that maybe, just maybe, we're close to the end of the rate hiking campaign after the unprecedented easiness the economy enjoyed for years after the financial crisis, which, as you know, I mean, this undertaking of undoing it, that really had Wall Street worried all autumn.
Well, and now they're not? Now they think that's it?
Well, if you think about the Curb Your Enthusiasm snapback today, where Wall Street say, we don't know for sure, actually. You know, Alan Greenspan was infamously gnomic in the 90s and early aughts, where you really had to read the tea leaves of what he said. And the sentiment today is, you know, maybe Powell, he doesn't have this newfound dovishness. Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan, they chimed in to reiterate that they, in fact, see 4 rate hikes ahead, which is not what that rally seemed to be romancing.
Yeah, well, and Powell had said in October that the Fed's benchmark interest rate was a long way from neutral. There weren't fundamental changes to the economy in the last month that would shift his thinking, were there?
No, but you did have the volume ratcheted up by Donald Trump saying he's not one bit happy. You have the market and the volatility. You never know if they are getting these esoteric inputs that are suddenly going to cause them to say even the language can channel a different reaction and suddenly send the bond and stock markets moving higher.
But we just spoke in the last month with Alan Greenspan, the former Fed chair, and I asked him about some of the language coming from President Trump. And he said, in all the presidents I worked for, I didn't have a single president who said to me, please raise interest rates. So he said he thought that the Fed chair right now, Jerome Powell, President Trump's pick, by the way, would do exactly what he did and other Fed chairs have done, which is ignore what the president says. It's supposed to be an independent body. If you're saying that the volume from the White House is making a difference, isn't that a problem?
I mean, look, it's certainly all over the press, and Trump kind of, you know, he likes to move to his own drumbeat. But pundits are now wondering if the central bank is succumbing to what he's doing, which is a moral hazard of itself. And like you said, I don't think any president in the Fed era has been happy with anything but easy rates. But it's the Fed's job, as Greenspan said, to be cold-eyed about the balance between employment and price pressures. And Donald Trump is not exactly a cold-eyed person.
So I guess we should expect that at the Fed meeting in December, there will not be another rise in interest rates?
No, actually, there still seems to be a consensus that there's another hike almost certainly. But what's going to be scrutinized is the language. Stock prices are high, unemployment's low, inflation doesn't seem to be all that problematic. The rates are still seen on balance as stimulative. I look back to where they were before the financial crisis, Jeremy, 5.25%. We're still nowhere near that. And maybe we won't have to go back to that in this cycle. We do know that the Fed largely whiffed on preparing for that calamity. And there's concern now that it could mess up the unwinding of its response to that calamity.
Just quickly, any expectation, Robin, that there's going to be a trade deal with China or some easing of the trade war in the next couple of days in Argentina?
There's going to be all sorts of tea leaf reading with that. I mean, you know, Robin Young just had an interview with, unfortunately, a slain captive from several years ago. China is holding two American young people with ties to China, a Georgetown student and his younger sister. And that's just one of the bargaining chips in a very difficult debate over these tariffs.
Robin Farzad, host of Full Disclosure. Thank you.
Thank you.
And let's now continue our look at the fourth National Climate Assessment, the major government report on climate change, released last week by the White House. This week, the president said he was skeptical of the findings in part because our air and water is at record clean. But the report has a whole chapter on water, and one of its conclusions is that human-caused climate change is already affecting water quantity and quality in the U.S. Oop Manulal, director of the Water Center at Columbia University, co-authored the National Climate Assessments chapter on water. Professor, welcome.
Thanks, Robin. How are you?
I'm fine, but our water doesn't seem to be. You write, water security in the U.S. is increasingly in jeopardy. Let's tick through some of the things that you are looking at. For instance, we have depleted groundwater, diminishing snowpack. It's raining more in places where it should be snowing.
Yes, there's definitely evidence of that as part of warming. Basically, we end up storing the precipitation in the winter as snow, and then it's available during the melt period. So the main issue would be if it now starts coming as rain, we need new mechanisms for storing that water for later use.
Yeah. And we already know that this impacts areas that are already suffering droughts, and you have water managers in the Southwest trying to figure out how to share the Colorado River. What's some of the impact when we don't have as much water as we need in areas?
Well, as it stands today, much of our water infrastructure is now aged. It's beyond its design life. And the example I'll give you is dams. We have around 88,000 dams in the United States that are taller than 15 meters. The median age of these dams is around 70 years, and the design life was around 50 years. So if you bring up the concern of how do we balance the transition from snow to rain or persistent droughts, then the buffering capacity that was provided by these dams is now questionable. Mm-hmm. And also, this is one of the reasons groundwater is being depleted, because if there's not enough stored behind the dams, then people will tap groundwater and then that gets depleted because mm-hmm. the rate at which groundwater recharges is very, very slow.
So, yeah, you've just described a cycle. First of all, these dams as a buffer against not having enough snowpack, for instance. But if mm-hmm. the dams are damaged, and they have been, I mean, your report cites the South Carolina dam failure in 2015, mm-hmm. North Carolina 2016 after tropical storms, the Oroville Dam spillway cracked during heavy rains in 2017. So this is just current weather, never mind weather that is to come. And will the infrastructure, will the dams hold? But even right now, you say that they're not in good shape. And so people start using groundwater more. Talk about groundwater. What's some of the danger of climate change for groundwater?
Well, the buffering capacity of groundwater is what we hope to rely on during droughts. But what has been happening, and this is in part, again, not a climate change story, but just a policy story, is that the way water rights are structured in the U.S., and also the where the crops are being grown, thanks to crop insurance subsidies that the federal government puts forward, we have an unsustainable trajectory for water use, and that's a big problem. Mm. So the concern with climate change that comes forward is that if we currently start depleting groundwater because of inappropriate policy structures, then later when we need it, we won't have it.
You know, some have forecast into the future, you know, even wars and violence, people fighting over water. Do you see that?
I personally don't see that. I think the challenges that we foresee may be just as important looking at past climate as at future climate. And the reason I say that is if you just look at the last 100 years, that was a relatively moderate climate period in the context of the previous 500 to 1,000 years over North America. We had continental scale droughts that were quite severe in the 13th century, 14th century transition periods. And if we were to experience those today, then we would be already in trouble. However, I think the trajectory that we have seen is that we have had increasing water use efficiency over time. Mm. And so at least in North America, this is not an issue. Globally, there will be places that will be more stressed, and there will be a strong pressure for migration out of those areas or a humanitarian demand. That is indeed possible. And even in those areas, I would say, even if you are not a believer in anthropogenic climate change, what we have seen in the paleoclimate is quite concerning.
Yeah. Well, and just to expand on some of the things that are giving you some hope, because you talk about better water management, we have things like tighter plumbing codes that have led mm-hmm. to overall decrease in household water consumption. People are using dishwashers, which, believe it or not, use less water than hand washing, mm-hmm. things like that. And you have reservoir operators, I understand, who are really being conscious of how much water they're releasing and trying to store more water. So we have more water management. But let's talk some more about the problems that you and others see in this report. For instance, we have seawater more and more coming up onto mm-hmm. land. What does that do?
So we will have intrusion of salt water into groundwater systems. Of course, we have groundwater depletion in the Midwest and in California and the Southwest more generally. But along the East Coast, we also have significant groundwater depletion. In our neighborhood, New York City gets water from surface reservoirs from the Delaware and Catskill systems. So we don't have significant groundwater use. But in Rockland County, which is adjoining New York City, and also in Long Island, there is groundwater use. Mm-hmm. And as sea level rises, that would be a threat. Yeah. Of course, there's a threat for inundation and nuisance flooding, and then in the event of a hurricane, more catastrophic flooding if the sea levels were higher.
Well, but you have the warming temperatures that also have been creating those algae blooms, like the mm-hmm. horrific one we saw in Florida, these blooms that are fed by nutrients from farm, you know, wastewater mm-hmm. treatment plants, the water that runs off into other areas, and warm rivers, life-threatening for things like salmon. Also, we have farming, and we understand now that a lot of the water that's used for farming is evaporating and so is kind of wasted because of the heat. Who's going to be most affected by climate change effects on water, and what should they be doing?
So you sketched out a very good storyline on ecological impacts, but you also pointed out that quite a bit of that ecological impact really comes from nutrient runoff from farms. Mm-hmm. Not wanting to bash agriculture for high water use and high pollution, what I would say is that there is significant opportunity for improvement in both nutrient application, pesticides application, and water conservation. So I'm going to point to that area where strategically, through public and private partnerships, and actually NGOs are very active, environmental NGOs are very active in this space, there is great opportunity for improvement, and the reduction of the loadings and abstraction of water from river systems.
Mm. Look, there's so much here, Professor Lal, but I do want to ask you one last thing, and I don't mean this in a mocking way, but I'm sure you heard President Trump say he didn't believe the report because, for instance, we have record clean water and clean air. What would you say to him or anyone of the same thinking to get across your concerns about water?
So interestingly, he also said last week that clean air and clean water are very important and he's fully supportive of them. I would leverage that and say, let's do it. Meaning let's go forward on that idea and ensure that we do have clean water and air. We published a paper earlier this year. The lead author on that was Maura Allaire from the University of California at Irvine, but she was previously at Columbia, where we document that there are increasing trends for safe drinking water violations across the country. And they are highly concentrated in areas that are rural, small cities, in the South, in the Midwest, predominantly in areas that heavily supported President Trump in the election. So let's do it.
Upmanu Lal, professor of engineering at Columbia University, director of the Columbia Water Center, and co-author of the fourth National Climate Assessment chapter on water. Professor, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Some sobering news today about the nation's health. Life expectancy in the United States declined between 2016 and 2017, according to the Centers for Disease Control. It is the first time U.S. life expectancy has fallen in a three-year period since World War I. Health officials attribute the small but significant dip to what experts call diseases of despair, drug overdoses, and suicides. Let's bring in NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Jeremy.
So an American born in 2017 can now expect to live 78.6 years. That is about a month less than those born in 2016. Doesn't sound like a lot, but it is considered a pretty significant dip.
Yeah. And that's, of course, an average. So it doesn't mean that every American born in 2017 will live that long. But I should say that 1 year alone is not that meaningful. But it is the trend that's causing the heartburn. And, you know, life expectancy has been getting steadily longer for decades. And having it plateau or even falling back, as we're seeing now, is not a good sign. And this started showing up in the data 3 years ago. Last year, it turns out that the life expectancy flattened out. We thought it had declined, but the data were revised. And it turns out it was no better than the year before. And it's possible that this year also, when they revise these figures, that it won't actually appear as a drop. So as I say, one particular year doesn't matter. But when you see the change over year after year, which seems to be piling up now, that's what's giving everyone heartburn.
And it is really about a spike in death among young people bringing down that number. And these people are dying because, as we said, of suicide and drug overdose.
Yeah, and also accidental death, you should mix into that as well. Drug deaths in 2017 were their highest ever, over 70,000 deaths in this country from drug overdoses. And, you know, that's far more than traffic accidents ever claimed. And this is due, of course, to the opioid epidemic, which we've been hearing so much about. But it's also important to say that suicide is a big part of that picture. And they're related. The same despair that has driven some people to drugs has also driven others to suicide. And, you know, and actually some of the accidents deaths may be just people who don't care anymore. It's like, they're not being precious enough, thinking preciously enough about their life to say, you know, I really have to drive carefully or whatever, because whatever happens, happens. So they all mix in and add to this story of despair.
But we have started to see some encouraging signs when it comes to the opioid epidemic. Maybe in some places, the number of deaths hit their peak last year, that they're not as bad this year. But when you look at this number, what does it say about efforts to curb that opioid epidemic?
Yeah, well, the story has not yet been told on this year. So there's been some preliminary data that suggests that things are leveling out, but I'll believe that when I see that. Mm-hmm. What we are seeing is that the efforts are uneven. We've seen some improvement in states that have risen to the challenge and are actually trying to treat addiction, but there's still far too few resources being applied to this problem. And And so you see some places where it's getting better, some places where it's getting worse. And in the meantime, these very inexpensive and dangerous synthetic drugs are showing up. And people may not even know they're taking them, which is part of the problem. They don't know what dose they're getting. And that's really driving a lot of this, is these synthetic drugs that are so dangerous.
And heart disease and cancer are still the top two causes of death in the U.S.?
They are. And it's interesting, though, because when you look at the long-term trend of heart disease, since the 1960s and 70s, actually, most of the improvement in life expectancy in this country has been due to a very dramatic decline in heart disease. That's partly because people have stopped smoking. People are taking drugs like statins and blood pressure medications. Heart disease and also treatments have improved for heart disease. So heart disease has steadily been driving this improvement in overall health. And we're seeing that plateau. So this is really, in some ways, the long-term trend, more than what's happening with the drugs and suicides. We're seeing that flatten out. And so then these makes these other problems come to the surface much more readily. And heart disease is pretty much flattened out this year. Cancer, actually, which is the second leading cause of death, has shown some improvements, partly, again, because people aren't smoking as much, and lung cancer is becoming less of a cause of death in this country, and partly because there have been some improvements in cancer treatment as well.
Well, and I think across the board, you look at a lot of the medical advances that we've seen in this country over the last several years, you would expect the numbers to be getting better, not worse. But as you say, with drug overdoses and suicide, that is not what's happening right now. What about when you compare us to the rest of the world? Life expectancy is on the rise in other developed nations. What's wrong with the United States?
Well, it is a lot of the things we've been talking about, but I would like to add another factor into this conversation, which is obesity. As you may know, about 40% of Americans are now seriously overweight. They're obese, and many more people are just overweight. And that actually increases the risk of death from diabetes, from heart disease, certain kinds of cancer, stroke, and kidney disease. And, you know, I spoke earlier today with Bill Dietz, who's chair of the Redstone Global Center for Prevention and Wellness at George Washington University here in D.C., and he pointed out that's really an urgent long-term issue to address here in this country. It's about more than that. It's about also creating a society where people can get good food, they can get good exercise, they have access to mental health treatment, which is still a big problem in this country, and they feel like they're part of a community. I mean, these are the so-called social determinants of health, and the U.S. is really doing poorly on that score, especially compared with countries where life expectancy is still on the rise.
Thanks, Richard, for bringing us obesity a week after Thanksgiving to be concerned about. Richard Harris, NPR Science Correspondent. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson, along with Robin Young. It's Here and Now.